All right, we are back with part two of our podcast with Tom Doak. If you missed part one, check it out on our iTunes page or on our website. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, please rate us or leave a review in iTunes. And without further ado, here is Tom Doak.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your life as a golf course critic and, you know, the travels and, you know, obviously playing great golf courses and seeing different architecture has to help your architectural career. But for a golfer with limited accessibility, what would be your three destinations abroad or in the States that you would recommend traveling to?
Oh man, it's a big question. It's a big world.
Yeah.
You know, Scotland and Ireland are geared to the golf tourist that, you know, isn't necessarily a member of a club. I mean, you don't have to have any clout to go play Ballybunion. You just sign up in advance and pay the green fee, and you're there. And you know, you're getting to see some of the best courses in the world, and, you know, most people don't have that much experience with Lynx golf. So, you know, and you're getting to see the game the way it started and why it started that way. You know, if you get to spend long enough over there, you know, like I did spending a year over there after college, you know, it really becomes a part of you that, you know, it's just a different ethos of golf. So, you know, that would always be my first choice. And I get back there fairly regularly, although kind of with my book project, I've committed myself to going other places. And I'd be happy just going back to England or Scotland all the time, but I've still got some places that I want to see. You know, Australia is pretty much the same. You know, the best courses in Australia, well, now there's a couple of them like Barnboogle that, and the new ones at King Island that are open to the public. But, you know, even a place like, you know, it helps a little bit if you can write and say, I'm a member of a club in the States. But I think you can play them even if you're not, if you write a nice letter. And those are tremendous golf courses. And, you know, and again, you know, they have a lot to teach us too, especially in terms of like how they use water on golf courses and how dry and firm they keep it, because it doesn't rain much in Sydney and Melbourne, and they have to be more efficient with water. And, you know, California has a lot to learn from Australia in how to manage water on golf courses. And, you know, you'll never see bunkering like that anywhere else. You'll never see a bunch of par threes as good as you'll see, like, on every course in Melbourne. So that's a great destination, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime place for most people, but definitely worth the trip. And then, you know, there's a lot of great resorts in America, and, you know, I'll plug Bandon Dunes. I mean, you know, being able to go there for a few days and, you know, and just stay there and play all those courses and see how different they are, and, you know, it really does feel like something in the west of Ireland or somewhere in Britain in terms of how the golf courses play. You know, it's a tremendous place to go, and it's a cool thing to have been a part of.
And everybody gets the chance to play two of your golf courses, so that's it's a big plus.
Yeah, I'm plugging my own work there a little bit. I've done some stuff in Australia too, and it's not bad.
Yeah. So, what course did you go to, whether it's public or private, in the States, where you walked in with very low expectations and were most pleasantly surprised?
Well, it's happened a lot over the years, although it's harder to do now. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember like going to Cruden Bay for the first time in Scotland and, in 1982, and I'd only ever seen one picture of it. So, I knew just enough to know, well, this could be pretty exciting because this one picture looks like it's a pretty spectacular piece of land. But I had no idea what the golf holes were going to be like until I got there. And that, that sense of discovery of going around it for the first time and seeing all these cool and wild things, we've kind of lost that a little now because any golf course you want to know about, you can find 1,000 pictures of on the internet now. But I still go places that I'm surprised that, even if I've seen some pictures of them, it's like, either because they've done a good restoration or because, they're just not, usually it tends to be private clubs. So they're not marketing it. Mm-hmm. The trip I made last year that was a real eye opener was going across Iowa. There's no golf courses in Iowa that are rated in the Golf Digest or Golf Magazine list. And there's no Alistair McKenzie courses or Tillinghast courses. There's not anything about it where you think, well, oh yeah, that's going to be a different golf destination. But, the first course I saw, if you're coming from the east, you go across the Mississippi River and you're there in the Quad Cities region, and the very first golf course when you go across the bridge about 2 miles is an Allison course called Davenport Country Club that they just did a restoration of. It's a terrific golf course. I mean, we do consulting for Milwaukee Country Club and the Country Club of Detroit, which are two of the best Allison courses in the state, and I thought this was better than the two of them.
Wow.
And yet nobody's, I've never heard that from anybody. So, again, it's a private club, it's in Iowa. They don't market themselves at all. So who's going to know that?
Yeah.
And it was part of the reason it's not on the Golf Digest list. Up till their renovation, it was only like 6,300 or 6,400 yards. So they were dismissing it on that basis. And it's still, now it's 6,700, which is just plenty for me, but there's probably some Golf Digest panelists who think that's not long enough.
Well, I think so then, we're both on the same page with those, with the panel ratings, but...
But there were like 5 or 6 courses in Iowa that I really thought were pretty cool. And, one of them was a Donald Ross course, Cedar Rapids, that they just renovated and did a great job with. One of them was a Perry Maxwell course, the one for Iowa State University. It has a typically wild Perry Maxwell greens on it. And there was a new course outside of Des Moines that Keith Foster did, which is probably the best solo design of his career. So there was really a lot there, and it's just the fact that they're private and they don't, they're not like Northern Michigan where they pool their advertising dollars and run ads in Golf Digest, so you don't hear anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in the state next to Iowa, and I have played no golf in Iowa. I think I've only been there when I visited the University of Iowa, so this sounds like somewhere I gotta go this summer.
Well, it's funny too, because I never thought, when I was there, it was like cold and windy and that. I was there like 1st of April or something, and it had been really nice in March, and then it was cold and windy in April, and it was just, I just froze my butt off for 4 days walking around seeing all these courses and trying to play in it once. But that's another thing. It's windy in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing for golf. It makes the golf a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it adds the element, and it's different than what a lot of people experience in places like Chicago or Philadelphia,
right,
where you've got
right.
lots of trees. So what architects have you gained a lot of appreciation for from all these travels and playing all these courses?
Too many to list. I mean. Mm-hmm. There's 4 guys that get most of the attention, and then there's 4 or 5 others like George Thomas because he wrote his book and did a couple of courses that are, you know, prominent tour sites, that they get a fair share of attention. And then most of the other golf course architects who worked back in the old days, you know, aren't well known today. Somebody like Bill Langford, who worked around Chicago, or Perry Maxwell, who did some of his best work building golf courses for Alistair McKenzie, but then did some great stuff on his own. Or Walter Travis. You know, we've worked on a couple of Travis golf courses, and I've been consulting at Garden City Golf Club for approaching 30 years now. You know, they all did some terrific work, and all, you know, all at this sort of detail level. You know, they didn't necessarily have a spectacular oceanfront site, but the greens they built and the, you know, the bunkers they built, the featuring, and they, you know, they some of them were working on some pretty rugged terrain, and so they came up with golf holes that are just different than the kinds of things you see now. You know, they're hillier, and the, you know, the landing area, their original landing area might have been designed at 220 yards, so now you can blow it over that, but you do so at your peril, because it really wasn't meant, you know, it really wasn't meant to be played that way, and you can get yourself in a lot of trouble trying to go for it. I've seen so many cool things, and I've seen more than a couple that were designed by people you never heard of, or nobody even really remembers who the heck built it. And, you know, and yet it's a cool golf course. So, you know, I wish people didn't pay as much attention to the names as they do. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds crazy. I mean, you know, my living is the fact, you know, part of the reason I make a good living is the fact that people know who I am. But, and that's, you know, it's hard to, you know, I can't remember, like, years ago, either Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus, I think it was Palmer, said, you know, he'd really like it if people came to play one of his courses and they really liked it, but they didn't even know who built it. I thought, well, yeah, but that's hard to do when they put your picture on the scorecard.
That's very, very true. I had some Twitter questions I put up, and want to get to some of those. So Jay Rigdon wants to know, what are the best nine-hole courses that you've seen, and how do you, you know, rate them compared to an 18-hole course?
The best nine-hole course I've seen is Royal Worlington in Newmarket in England, which the Cambridge Golf team uses, so it's semi-famous. But, you know, there's one that, you know, its origin is a little bit of a mystery. Harry Colt had something to do with it at some point, but the guys who designed it originally are really kind of no names. And yet, I mean, it's on a tight piece of land, and it's fairly unassuming looking. There's actually a road, the road that goes by the clubhouse and goes alongside the first and second hole. You know, you play over the road at the ninth hole, so you're actually driving through the golf course, and you could drive through that golf course and not give it a second glance thinking, oh, wow, that's really cool. But you get out in the middle of the first fairway and look at the shot you've got into the green, and it's like, oh, my goodness. And it's nine holes of that. I mean, there's nine really good holes on a nine-hole golf course, which you don't see that much. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a handful of others. Whitensville in Massachusetts is a Donald Ross course, and I think that's probably the best nine-hole course in America. Gil Hance just did a bunch of restoration work on it, made it that much better. But, you know, I've been going there. I haven't been there that many times, but the first time I went there was like 30 years ago this summer. So it's always been a favorite. Another one that I saw for the first time a year or two ago was Hooper in New Hampshire. It's kind of like not that far north of Hartford, Connecticut. You just go up through Massachusetts and you're right there. Stiles and Van Cleek course, or maybe just Stiles actually, but terrific piece of ground. Mm-hmm. And then the Dunes Club that Mike Kaiser built, pretty close to my lost dunes down in the corner of Lake, in the corner of Michigan as you're going around the lake towards Chicago.
Yeah.
Which is a really neat, fairly freeform golf course. And, you know, I saw it the first time when it was brand new and before I'd met Mike and saw, you know, just some of the way they'd done tees, more freeform and stuff. I thought, wow, this is really, you know, this is the kind of guy I'd like to work for. I'm glad I had the chance. As far as how I rate them, I kind of informally think, you know, it costs them 1 point on the Doak scale that they're only a 9-hole course.
Okay.
You know, because it's like, you know, if you, you know, there are some very good golf courses that there's 1 9-hole that's great and the other 9 holes kind of suck. I won't go into specifics today. Yeah. I saw one of those pretty recently, actually, that I thought, well, yeah, this 9 holes is great. And the other 9 holes is like, they shouldn't have even built it. They should just play the one good 9 twice. But I do that with recognition that it's harder to build 18 great holes than it is to just build 9 great holes. But at the end of the day, if you've got a really good 9-hole course, you know, that's a great golf course. And there's no reason to knock it down that much because there's only 9 in the hole, because you can go play them again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just so people that aren't familiar, Tom came up with a Doak scale, which is how he rates golf courses. It's a 1 through 10, and there he rates them all in his books called the Confidential Guide to Golf Courses. I highly recommend them if you're into golf courses. They are just terrific things to just read through and great ways to figure out where you want to play next. Tom, tell us a little bit about how you came up with the Doak scale.
It's really kind of a lark. I mean, you know, the original version of the Confidential Guide was just written for, I printed 40 of them and gave them away to friends and people mm-hmm. that had helped me go around and see some of these golf courses. You know, like I gave George Pepper a copy, and I gave Ben Crenshaw a copy, and I gave Pete Dye a copy. You know, it was, because I was writing just for friends, it was very off the cuff and informal and brutally honest. You know, if I didn't like a famous course, I just said, don't bother ever going to this place. And they're making fun of a hole that I thought was terrible or whatever. And, you know, and I never really intended for it to be seen by more than a handful of friends. But, you know, I came up with the Doak scale, and given the courses a 0 to 10 rating was kind of a shorthand, because I realized, you know, I think the first book covered like 600 or 700 golf courses. So I only had room to write a paragraph or two about the golf course, and I couldn't really cover it. You know, it wasn't like I was going to cover it hole by hole. So I just thought, well, you know, I want to put a number with it. So, you know, if I write about Augusta, and, you know, because everybody's already read a million things about Augusta, and all these people I've given this book to know Augusta, you know, I want to write what I don't like about Augusta. But then I don't want everybody to think, well, he hates Augusta. He thinks it's the worst golf course in the world because he wrote 2 paragraphs that are bad about it. So the number was kind of like, no, you know, it's still a 9 on my 1 to 10 scale. It's mm-hmm. not a 10, but it's not a 5. I mean, I really like the golf course. So, you know, the number was kind of a safety valve check originally, but, you know, when I decided on the advice of all my friends that I should really publish the book for the mainstream, because it was, you know, basically it was what I knew about golf course architecture was from seeing all those golf courses, and it would be good for my career to put that out there, even if it was controversial. You know, then the numbers became like the whole point for most people, which is too bad. I mean, you know, the to me, the book is still about what I have to write about the golf course. You know, why do I think you should go here? What's interesting about this golf course that would make you want to travel all the way to see it? Mm-hmm. That's really the purpose of the book. You know, it's not meant to be Doak critiques every architect who ever lived. It's meant to be like, you only have so much time, Andy. So if you're going to England, you know, which of these courses should you try to go see? And it's written in a way that, yes, I've got numbers on them, and you could say, well, I'll go to all the nines and the eights and the sevens, and I'll use that as a cutoff. You know, but that's not really, you know, you shouldn't even do that. You should read what I say about the golf courses, and you should look at which ones are close together and go, oh, yeah, he only gave that a five, but it sounds pretty cool, so maybe I should go see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but I'm not expecting it to be one of the top 100 courses in the world, but it's good, you know, it's going to be cool enough to go be worth spending 4 hours
on. Yep.
And that's, you know, and that's, you know, that's been the success of the books, that it works really well on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that go out of their way to see some course they never heard of because I recommended it are mostly pretty pleased by having made their detour.
Yeah. I think it's just a great resource for if you're unfamiliar with an area. You can learn so much about different courses and just figure out, you know, I always say to people they should have a purpose for why they want to play somewhere, and it does a great job of giving you a reason to go play somewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, I was involved in the rankings of courses with Golf Magazine back from almost the time they started doing it, and I'm not involved in that anymore. And I realized that, you know, all those rankings is just, you know, they've overpowered everything else. It's like, you know, I know these panelists that, like, they go to Asia for a week and they go play two courses in Korea and three in Japan and one in Thailand, and, you know, because they're quote-unquote top 100 golf courses or serious candidates for the top 100. And they drive right by, you know, Japan is the best example of that. You know, Kasumi Gaseki used to be ranked in the top 100 golf courses. And I can't remember if it still is now or not. But there was another course that Allison had something to do with, Tokyo Golf Club, that's next door to it. And for years, panelists never went there. They would go to Kasumi Gaseki because it was in the top 100 and they wanted to see all the top 100. And nobody would go, you know, it's not even across the street. It's like, forks off the same driveway. But you couldn't get anybody to go there, you know, because they had to get on a plane to go to Thailand tomorrow instead. And that just bothered the hell out of me. You know, I just think, well, you know, go see, you know, actually go, if you're going to take a golf trip to Japan, for God's sake, go see Japan.
Mm-hmm. It's
and that's, you see the same thing in Scotland. You know, people go to Scotland, and, you know, if their first trip to Scotland, they think, well, I may never get to do this again in my life, so I've got to go see all the Open Championship courses in Scotland, but I also want to see Dornoch because everybody says it's a great golf course. So, you know, so that means that you're driving 2 hours from Edinburgh to St. Andrews, and you're driving 2 or 3 hours more to get over to Troon, and then you're driving like 5 hours to get up to Dornoch and 5 hours coming back. And you skip so many good golf courses in between there, it's a joke.
Yeah, and you're all that time in the car, you could have played 2 or 3 more rounds of golf and seen, you know, it's like,
exactly. Oh,
just because they're an open road, of course, doesn't mean for the 10 handicap that it's the best place to go play. I think, you know, that's...
No, the only thing it means is it's the most expensive golf course you're going to see in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, they charge $250 for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there could be a good golf course down the street that they're still only charging $60 for because it's not so well-known. And that's, you know, so that's part of, you know, that's part of the confidential guide, too. It's like, you know, my little intros to the different sections are basically, for God's sake, don't do that. You know, mm-hmm. If you're going to Scotland, just assume that you're going to like it and want to go back again someday. So don't try to touch all the bases this trip. Just, you know, pick a couple areas and see some of the little golf courses because, you know, a lot of times you get more out of them. I mean, it's like, you know, if you're staying around, say, you know, if you're staying around where Muirfield is out there to the east of Edinburgh, and, you know, and you take time to play North Berwick and you take time to play Gullin, but maybe you've got time to go see like Kilspindie too, this little 5,400 yard golf course that's a, you know, par 68, and the first tee is like literally, you know, as soon as you step off the pavement, the walkway from around the clubhouse, you're on the tee. And it's the first hole, the par three, and the green's like 160 yards right over there, but it's a really hard shot. And then the 18th green is like steps away from the first tee. And, you know, it was 5,400 yards, and most Americans would dismiss that, but then they go and play it, and it's not so easy. And it's a very intimate little place, and you play it in like 2 hours because it's so compact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have that experience somewhere to understand that, you know, golf courses don't all have to be the same, and they don't all have to be 7,000 yards long.
Yeah.
But if all you go to is the Open Championship courses, you know, they've all been rectified. And, you know, they're not, you know, they're not as quirky as everything else in Scotland. And they're really cool. By far the coolest part of going to Scotland is that you will see some things that you would never see anywhere else, because, you know, you can't tell the Scots that they don't know about golf. You know, you can't tell them, well, 5,400 yard course, that's no good. They're like, of course it's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of fun. What are you talking about?
It's funny. My buddy's going exactly to Edinburgh, and I recommended North Berwick and Gullin, but that's a perfect Kilspinary is the perfect recommendation for him, because he's asking for more. Jeff wants to know, what are five courses in North America that you haven't played yet that are on your list?
You know, that's hard for me to answer, because I've been, you know, part of the reason for going back and updating the confidential guide is to check some of these places off my list.
Mm-hmm.
But then I have to admit too that I don't always have time to play everywhere. You know, I'm trying to see a bunch of courses so I can tell other people about them, and I don't always have time to play, or I get there and it's 38 degrees and blowing at 30 miles an hour, and I could go out and play in that, but if I did, then I'm not going to go see the course 20 miles down the road too. So the only one that comes to the top of my head of, you know, I mean, I've played most of the top 50 golf courses in the world. And, you know, I think the only one that I haven't played is Oakmont. I've been to Oakmont like 3 or 4 times, and it never worked out for me to play when I was there. You know, it was like, I was welcome to play, but they had an event going on, or I was going to play, but we got rained out or something. So one of these days I'm going to go do that, because I really love the golf course. But, you know, I wish I had more time to play golf. I mean, I get invitations from people all the time. Oh, come play here with me. And it's like, boy, I'd love to. but I'm traveling a lot of days still building golf courses. And then I'm crazy enough to take on this book project, and it means I need to go see golf courses in Korea and Vietnam this year. And I just don't have much time to get back to Nebraska and play.
Mm-hmm. So I got this question a couple times. Easiest change for a golf course to make that would have the biggest effects in terms of improving it, I assume.
Well, you know, I don't do a lot of like renovation projects where we really change a golf course dramatically. I mean, we do restoration projects, but trying to take a golf course that's not that great and turn it into something great, I've kind of avoided, because it's all a matter of opinion.
Yep.
You know, and when you've got 300 members that join the place because presumably they kind of like it, you know, blowing it up and turning it into something different is a really big, you know, you're going way out on a limb to do that. So, you know, to me, the two things that make a golf course really good are the routing and the set of greens. And, you know, it's really almost impossible to change the routing of a golf course after it's been there for 50 years and they've you know, planted trees and done everything else to reinforce the routing, you know, changing it and just completely redoing it, you're just blowing it up and making a whole new golf course. So I won't take that as an example. You know, the best thing that you could possibly do, the biggest impact by far would be building a really good set of greens. But again, that's a step that most clubs don't want to make because you got to close the golf course to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're basically closing for a year to rebuild the greens. But that would certainly be the most impactful thing. You know, as far as the easiest thing to do, to me, it's getting the mowing lines right. You know, getting the corners of the greens back to where they used to be so you can jam a pin over in the corner. Because most old golf courses, those things have kind of got rounded off over time. And you know, the very coolest little edges of the golf course just aren't in play the same anymore. Mm-hmm. Same with, you know, getting the fairway lines back to the right places. You know, that sometimes that introduces a lot of strategy back to the golf course that it's just, you know, it's been narrowed up kind of arbitrarily to get it to 30 yards wide because that's what the sprinkler here covers. And, you know, they've missed being kind of the hole when they did that.
Yeah, that's I see that at the course I play at. There's one green, it's a Donald Ross. There's one green that used to be this massive green, and like half the green is missing because of sprinklers. And you see this, like, where this green used to go, and it's like, that might have been the best green in all of Chicago. But
which is that?
It's a Calumet Country Club. It's down by the Flossmoor and Olympia and Ravislow. It's a highway cut through it, and now it's, you know, overgrown, kind of the story of a lot of Chicago country clubs. But they're starting to take trees down, and we're getting it back. But there's this one green that is just unbelievable if they could get it back. But there's, you know, it's a club that's low on money. And there's a sprinkler right in the middle of where that part of the green would be. So
yeah.
It's got constraints. So somebody asked if there was one, you know, one place you could play that's accessible to the public that you could walk in the afternoon with a Sunday bag, what course would it be? And that, you only get one.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing. I mean, I've been to 1,500 golf courses, uh-huh. And most of the best golf courses in the world. So any of these questions where anybody asks me, you only get one. I just have to laugh at. Like, so go back. What are my criteria?
Let's say it's it. Let's
walk it with a Sunday bag.
In the afternoon in the States. We'll say in the States.
In the States.
And it's accessible.
And it's accessible. And it's not mine. I'll throw in it's not mine.
We'll do that too. Yeah.
But the accessible part really narrows it down a lot. Paso Tiempo is a great course, and it's a little hilly for some people to walk, so that would be a little tough to recommend, but that's one of the first places that springs to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pick one that's not far from where I'm talking today in Traverse City. There's an old club in northern Michigan called Belvedere.
Yep.
Which is a semi-private club. They're only like, you know, basically the members are around for 2 months in the summer, and it's harder to get onto those 2 months. But the rest of the time, the public's welcome. All you have to do is call them. And, you know, it's a really cool, simple old golf course laid out on a farm by Willie Watson. And, you know, he liked it enough that when George Thomas was doing his book on architecture, he sent him a couple diagrams of the whole. It's actually three of them, and they're all in Thomas's book. So, you know, I sought out the place the first time I came up here, and it was kind of, you know, at that point, it was really kind of run down, and they didn't have much money to spend on it. But they've done a really nice job of fixing it up. And It was host for the Michigan Amateur for years and years and years. They just went back there every year, and everybody loved coming north and playing there. And then somebody at the Golf Association said, "Oh no, we have to move this around all over the state to different places, so not everybody has to go north every year." And you know, most of the good amateurs in Michigan are still pissed about that.
I've heard a lot of great things about it.
And it's a very simple golf course with a really good set of greens.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the time. You've been more than generous. We're going to get you out here. Last question, and then we've got an overrated, underrated segment we're going to throw at you. But last question is, you famously, through your book, through writing how much you'd love to do a Bel Air renovation, it sounds like you've secured, doing a Bel Air restoration. What would be the next golf course that you would most want to do a restoration of?
The Bel Air thing came up pretty funny because I think Rand Morissette asked me that question. And, we had just finished volume 2 of the Confidential Guide. So for some reason, Bel Air was on my mind and I just blurted it out. And, I should have been more careful because the problem with answering your question is there's always some consulting architect that's already working there. Which in Bel Air's case was Tom Fazio, and I just kind of stepped on him and said, geez, I wish they were doing something different. And I had no idea I even knew anybody at Bel Air, but it turned out I knew like two or three of the younger guys that were on the green committee, so they called me about it. And yeah, a year and a half later, we're gonna start a renovation there this fall. So now now I'm thinking, politics. Where can I say that somebody's not going to be mad that I said it, or I'm trying to steal their job away from them? So I don't even know if I can answer the question because of that. It's like,
hey, we'll give you a pass.
I mentioned that little 9-hole course I saw in New Hampshire, Hooper, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
It's barely hanging on as a golf course, surviving year to year. They don't even have enough money to keep their pretty little clubhouse open. It would not take very much to get it back to just looking perfect like they've done for Whitenfell. And I'd love to be part of that. I'd do that for a dollar because it's a cool little golf course. But, I'd only do it if they get their lease with the town right to make sure the place survives. And that seems to be an issue for them right now. So I don't know where that's going. I'd love to. It's a great golf course. I'd really love to help them.
Nobody's
consulting there, so I'm on safe ground.
Whoever's listening from the Northeast that has a passion for golf courses, that's the one they got to go check out. So this is going to be a new regular podcast segment. We're going to end it with overrated or underrated, and I've got six things here, and you just say overrated or underrated, and then we'll get you out of here.
No explanation.
Yep, okay. No explanation needed. Erin Hills.
Ooh. Overrated.
Template Hole Golf.
Overrated to me because I've seen so much of it.
Okay. Pebble Beach.
Used to be overrated, might be getting to be underrated now because it's like a popular, that place is overrated. I mean, there's still like, the best stretch of golf holes in America at Pebble Beach.
Yeah, that's it's funny how the pendulum swings with things. Double fairways.
Very overrated. I don't really like that as a design concept that much. I think people do it as a gimmick.
We'll throw in there with it double greens.
Same. Very overrated.
Okay. Whistling Straits.
Ooh. Overrated with, based on its Golf Digest rating, I guess, but you know, not overrated as a project. I mean, to turn what they started with into what they finished with is a pretty impressive feat. I just don't think it's one of the top 20 golf courses in America.
Yeah, it's I kind of agree with it's an amazing place you should go to, but it's not one of the top 25 courses you should see. And then last one, the Great Hazard.
The Great Hazard.
The, you know, Hell's Half Acre par 5 design that you used at Stream Song Blue.
Well, I said nearly everything else is overrated, but I'll say that's underrated. I mean, you still don't see it that much because, you know, people are afraid. Like, you know, even Stream Song, it's like, you know, we really debated, are we going to really cut this off or are we going to give people a way around it somehow? Because it's just, you know, that's more the politically correct thing to do. But, you know, that's why the Great Hazard is underrated. You don't see it that much anymore. It's a really cool feature, and you just don't get to see it because it's not politically correct.
Yeah, I love the Great Hazard. I think it's just genius, especially the way you did it at Stream Song, where if you have to lay up short of it, you still have a chance to get to the green.
Yeah, I think that's, for my case, that's the way to go is, you know, lay up and then you're like 200 or 220 to go, and but you could still pull it off if you hit a great shot.
Yeah, I love that you brought that back. It's something I want to see more of in the future. I think it's a great way to defend par fives and make it interesting. So Tom, I really appreciate the time. You've been awesome, and I'm sure all the listeners will love it, and We're looking forward to seeing more of your work, and thanks for coming on.
Hi, Andy. Nice to talk to you. And I'm curious to see how much response I'll get to this.
Yeah.
Hopefully I've said enough controversial things that you'll get some buzz.
Well, it'll be great. And then for everybody, Tom recently joined Instagram. It's @DokeGolf. Sounds like his interns got in his ear, and got him on a social media platform. So if you like seeing great golf courses, check it out.